Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another APS Portfolio Strategy Call. This one on the state of the single family rental market. I'm Steve Abrahams, head of investment strategy at Amherst Pierpont. On a long list of things that have been changed by the pandemic, you could definitely include the housing market. And when it comes to housing these days, really, you can pick your superlative. If you look at home prices, at least through April, they have been up 12% year over year, which is the fastest since 2006. Month's supply of homes, 2, which is the lowest on record. Home builder confidence, again, near a record. To put it in context, the NAHB index is at 86. The historical average, 52. So pick whatever you want. The housing market has definitely moved to a different level over the last 12 months. And frankly, it's not exactly what you would have predicted when economies started shutting down roughly a year from now. In the middle of this sits the single family rental market. And it has been partially changed by pandemic, but it also continues to ride the wave of some really important underlying developments in the economy and in the US demographics. We thought in the midst of all of this, it would be timely to pull together some experts to get together and give us a recap of SFR, an outlook for the market, and a review of some of the latest developments. And this afternoon, we really have a great lineup. We're going to be joined by Mary Beth Fisher, who's a senior investment strategist here at APS, Dan Teagan, a senior director at Kroll Rating Agency, who overlooks their activities in SFR, Kevin Gibbons, senior banker at APS, and Nick Grego, senior trader at APS that takes care of our primary pricing and secondary activity in SFR. We're going to take about 30 minutes for some general prepared remarks, and then we're going to open up the format to Q&A. And I would just remind you, for those of you who have joined us before, on the right side of your webinar panel, there's a chat box where you can ask or type in questions. That's going to be the way that we're going to do it these days. So feel free to ask those questions at any time during the webinar. We're going to save them until we get to the end of prepared remarks, and then we're going to tee them up for our participants. In any event, at this point, I really want to turn to Mary Beth Fisher, our senior analyst, for a recap of where the market has been and some really interesting developments that we're expecting ahead of us for single family rental debt. Mary Beth.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Steve. I want to jump in because I want to leave plenty of time for questions. So if we can go, this is a summary slide, and since it's a summary slide, I'm going to skip it and go to the next slide. So I want to talk about the scope of the single family rental market briefly first. And single family rentals make up anywhere from 50 to 55% of outstanding rental stock. And that's where they've been since the mid 1980s. This includes 15 million of single family detached homes and 23 million of single family rentals in 2 to 4 unit structures. Single family rental market has long been dominated by small mom and pop type operators, which own less than 10 properties. That's been 85% of the single family rental market over the years. The first portfolio of homes was sold to an institutional operator, that was actually Blackstone, in 2012. And that was the first time that an institutional operator came in, was it capable of buying a large portfolio of homes and set up public and private institutional operators have increased their footprint and are now estimated to own approximately 300,000 single family rental homes of that 15 plus 23 million, 38 million homes. So they only own about 2% of the outstanding stock. This has been relevant from a niche market, though overall, they're still have a very small footprint. institutional ownership of single-family rental homes did begin introduce institutional-style financing. So the first securitization backed by single-family rentals occurred in 2013, and since then, the single-family rental financing market in the public side has grown to 83 deals. They've raised cumulatively $46 billion in financing, with currently $27 billion outstanding. Kevin Gibbons on our investment banking team will talk a little bit more about the private side of the financing market. We can go to the next slide. The majority of single-family rental securitizations are in single-borrower deals. Single-borrower deals means that the borrower or loan sponsor is a single large institutional operator or REIT that typically owns and operates the single-family rental business. The underlying asset in these deals is one loan made to that borrower, where the loan is secured by an entire pool of several hundred to several thousand single-family rental properties and the cash flows generated from those properties. SFR deals are commonly referred to as a hybrid of CMBS and MBS. Features are Dan Teagan joining us from KBRA will be able to go into more detail on that. And we can advance to the next slide. There's a really important feature of the single family institutional operator market, and that's that there's some segmentation in the SFR operator market. And that segmentation is that it covers a variety of price points for average rent, for median house value, and for square footage of the house. Some of the operators, like Invitation Homes and American Homes for Rent, both specialize in larger homes with higher average rents, which attracts tenants with higher average incomes. In fact, those two operators attract tenants with median incomes above $70,000, between $70,000 and $80,000 per year. So these are, you know, middle class to trending towards upper middle class tenants. There are a few operators, and they're those ones at the bottom of the list, which do specialize in smaller homes with at lower price points, and they have lower average rents. The tenants that are there tend to have incomes, median incomes in the low 40,000s. One important point to note is that low-income households have the cutoff for low-income households, according to a Pew Research survey, is actually $40,000 per year. Now, it's like that can be a little bit flexible, but there are not any SFR operators, even these SFR operators that have the lowest median income of tenants, do not specifically target what would be considered the lower income tenant market. They certainly fluctuate down to that, but that is not their median price point. If we can go to the next slide. This is a fabulous slide, which is from actually Dan Teagan's firm, Kroll, which shows the geographic concentration of the properties that are currently in single family rental securitizations. And there's something to note right now from this, and it also talks about geographic segmentation, is that the majority of single family properties owned by institutions tend to be in the Sun Belt. They tend to be in places where the population is growing very rapidly, where there is a reasonable amount of developable land still available. If you look at the blank spots on that map, the Midwest, where the population has actually been declining for some time, and the Northeast Corridor, which the population has been stagnant to somewhat declining, but also there's very little available land outside of even the major urban centers in either of those areas. So that has not been traditionally where SFR operators have been targeting their holdings. And the last slide, which I want to talk about, is that there's been about $10 billion of capital raised late last year and early this year, specifically earmarked for single family rental institutional operators to go into the build to rent segment. And that's because of what Steve was talking about earlier, is they can't compete and there's not a lot of available land. And what they're trying to do is, instead of buying house by house by house, which is very inefficient, they're been entering the build for rent segment, and they're trying to build entire communities of single family rental housing. At $10 billion, if that's leveraged 3-to-1, that would put $30 billion in financing, in additional financing into the market over the next several months to several years. And we are expecting to see that part of the SFR markets expand. I will turn it back over to Steve.
All right. Thanks very much, Mary Beth. So I think Mary Beth has kind of sketched some of the broad strokes of what we see in single family rentals. And we want to turn now to Dan Teagan and get the rating agency view. Rating agencies obviously need to help the market and assess the credit risk, both in the sponsors and in the underlying collateral pools. So we hand the baton to Dan, if you could talk about how you approach those issues and where you see interesting developments these days in SFR.
Absolutely. Thanks, Steve. Hi, everyone. I'm Dan Teagan. I'm a senior director in KBRA's commercial real estate group, where I lead our SFR new issuance surveillance teams. As Mary Beth highlighted, we distinguish between SFR transactions between single borrower and multi-borrower. So single borrower, again, would be a deal that consists of a single loan secured by a portfolio of properties owned by a single institutional owner-operator, whereas a multi-borrower would be a deal collateralized by a pool of loans, typically to quasi-institutional or smaller mid-size borrowers. So just as far as context of issuance, so 2020 was a record year for SFR securitization issuance with 16 deals with a balance of over $9 billion. And so far in 2021, there have been 7 deals representing about $3.5 billion of issuance. So given the hybrid nature of the collateral and the source of cash flows coming from tenant rent payments of the income producing real estate, we really use elements for CMBS and RMBS methodologies to analyze the RMBS, that's for our securitization. So first we determine the estimate of the sustainable net cash flow for the underlying properties, just as we would in a CMBS deal for the underlying properties. And then we also calculate recoveries upon a liquidation of the pool under various home price scenarios, typically as we would in a RMBS transaction. So in conjunction with our credit analysis and to form our credit, our cash flow assumptions, we evaluate historical performance that's available for the portfolio that is provided by the operator related to their overall platform, or if it's specific to the subject portfolio that we're evaluating. We look to historical monthly rent collections, tenant delinquencies, in-place vacancy and credit loss, and then any market data that's available related to vacancy, rent, or home prices. And then we also look at structural features related to the loan or the capital structure itself. The most common that we see in the transactions that were introduced a few years ago are voluntary substitution and more recently some collateral lease features, and then any performance information that we have available related to the specific issuer or the overall sector. So from a performance perspective, both single borrower and multi-borrower securitizations performed relatively well over the downturn during COVID. This was really the first time that the sector experienced any stress. So during this time, home prices continued to hold up and were generally resilient. So the stress was really on the cash flow side, not on home prices. So since we did rate that first Invitation Homes deal that Mary Beth mentioned in 2013, since then we've rated 64 as far as securitizations, 50 of which were single borrower, 50 single borrower, 14 multi-borrower, and that represented over $35 billion in issuance volume. So on the single borrower side, 27 securitizations have paid off over the life of the sector, and we've upgraded a total of 65 securities with no downgrade. And for single borrower, there have been no defaults or special servicing transfers related to any of these loans. On the multi-borrower side, there were 2 transactions that have paid off, one of which was CoreVest's first securitization from 2015. And we've upgraded a total of 11 classes over the course of our rating of the multi-borrower deals. Some of the upgrades had happened following the start of the pandemic and were a function of deleveraging of the capital structures, mainly owing to lower lower implied LTVs that were really driven by home price appreciation and increases in cash flows. As far as metrics, some metrics go, I can provide multi-bar deals have had recurring borrower delinquencies, generally in 3%, 7% range, but very minimal losses to date. And of the loans that have been resolved, the average loss severity has been about 35%, which is similar to CMBS, which has been around 30%, but it is lower than small balance commercial loans that we've seen with loss severities that have been around 50% or more. So for, and then for single bar transactions, property level performance prior to the pandemic, that is, tenant delinquencies, they averaged about 1%. But more recently, those delinquencies increased to be close to 4% on average, with some of the transactions having delinquencies in excess of 5%. Occupancies have averaged above 95%. Rent collections have generally ranged in the 90 to 95% of the pre-pandemic collections, and rent growth has been about 3 to 3.5% year over year. Generally speaking, overall, the SFR rental rate increases have generally continued steadily increase and outpace any expense increases. So that's resulted in a deleveraging of the capital structure when we're looking at also from a home price appreciation perspective, when we're looking at it from a implied value, we're looking at implied values based on HPI information from CoreLogic and other benchmark sources. So some recently issued deals, they've had higher levels of delinquency, but we also consider the historical rent collections figures in our analysis, which we've seen typically recently have been in the mid to low 90s, but collections have also been following subsequent to the month due. So if we look 1 to 2 months thereafter, collections have typically been in the mid 90s to low to mid 90s, sometimes in the high 90s, depending on the operator. There's maybe some rolling 30-day delinquencies that are corrected, but on an ongoing basis. Just on a more macro basis, we continue to monitor the impacts on employment rates, interest rates, the eviction and moratoriums and foreclosure moratoriums that may be in place on a regional basis or local level, and what those impacts may have on the SFR sector overall. Kind of looking forward a little bit, we expect to see some continued consolidation within the industry. Most notably was the Pretium acquisition of the Front Yard platform. So combining with their own Progress Residential platform, and probably we would expect to see more consolidation in bulk portfolio acquisitions of the smaller or maybe mid-sized owner operators. With the prevalence of build to rent, there's been a minor inclusion in securitization to date, but the owner operators who've kind of focused more on one-off acquisitions or more focused on bulk type acquisitions, they may have more of an appetite for build to rent, given that there's significantly more competition in a lot of the same markets, with the overlapping geographic footprint that we see in a lot of the owner-operators' portfolios. Structural features that we've seen, really one of the things that I would expect to see are features that give the owner-operators more operational flexibility. So whether it's from a voluntary substitution or property release standpoint, the operators really have migrated from a time of rapid home price acquisitions to optimizing their existing portfolios. So anytime they have financing in place, then there's features and structural provisions in place that allow them operational flexibility for managing their portfolio. If they decide to exit a market or substitute properties, then that's something that I could see being more prevalent moving forward as well. So I'll turn it back over to Steve.
All right, thanks a bunch, Dan. So that's a quick recap, at least of background, and then from Dan's standpoint, what he's seeing, at least on its way to the public markets. But it turns out there's a very active and creative market in the private financing of SFR portfolios. And Kevin Givens is right in the middle of that. Kevin, could you share some of the things that you're seeing in the private financing market?
Sure. Thank you, Steve. On the topic of private financings, we've been very active here at APS in arranging private financing solutions for various operators within this SFR market to the tune of several billion over the last couple of years. This has included a range of firms in different strategies, asset classes, and geographies. The private financings that we arrange here at APS generally take the form of a loan or a private security and have attributes of both what an investor may find in a 144A security and in a bank warehouse line. Unlike bank warehouses, these facilities provide for longer term financing of the homes. And unlike in a 144A security, there's more flexibility offered to the SFR operator and more flexible collateral terms than one may find in a 144A securitization. And some of those terms tend to be akin to what one may find in a warehouse line. We generally will view the structure of these deals as some kind of a hybrid between a bank warehouse line and a 144A securitization. We think that this is valuable, and it's proven to be valuable for operators because it does give them the term capital from different investors, including insurance, regional banks, credit funds, and non-banks up and down the capital stack. So it gives them term financing, which is really a hedge against what many operators use in traditional warehouse with a large bank and then go to the term securitization market. So it gives them a level of funding diversification away from that market with partners that want to be active in the space and want to grow with them over time. We continue to see interest in these deals from an increasing number of investors. Beyond a wider array of investor interests, some of the recent trends we've seen in these private financings include flexibility to finance non-stabilized assets. We've seen a tremendous amount of interest here in 2021 in the Bill Tarrant financing arena for items that we'll discuss later on this call. We expect the trend of private SFR financing to continue to grow as it provides a number of specific benefits both to operators and to investors. Just going into the specifics, for operators, it provides them access to what we call sticky capital from people that want to partner with them and be long-term financing partners. Lots of institutional investors, no question, are interested in more exposure to the space. So this gives them the ability to match up with operators and to create terms that are beneficial for them. As we put the private financings in place, we serve the need that a traditional bank warehouse line will, which is we provide financing flexibility for assets that you wouldn't find in the 144A deals like non-stabilized homes. For investors, just kind of flipping the coin there, what's most interesting to them, why is this beneficial to them? Certainly start from the top, there's a relative value the benefit when you look at where these investors attach in the private deals compared to where they would attach in buying securities in the 144A market. There's a decent lift in spread premium there. They can lock up investments for a long period of time. 5 to 7 years are typical duration of our private financings. And most importantly, in a market like we're in right now, when investors are looking to put lots of dollars to work, this affords them the opportunity to put large quantities of dollars, typically triple digits, into specific financings. So as opposed to getting into a syndicate and they get what they get based on the demand supply technicals at the syndicate. They come in and they can put large dollars to work in what we call bespoke financing that fit their investor preferences. So, you know, just as a recap, it's an area that our banking teams are very active in. We've built up a nice suite of investors. We have a long list of SFR clients that we banked as well, and we see continued growth in the space. With that, I'll hand it back to you, Steve.
All right, thanks a bunch, Kevin. And let's go ahead and now turn to Nick Grego. Nick, can you give us a sense of what you see on SFR in secondary and how the market tends to frame that asset against potentially other competing investments?
Absolutely, Steve. Thanks. So just looking back, I mean, thinking about how these deals come from a new issue perspective, as Daniel had mentioned earlier, there have been a number of new issue deals come already this year, and they tend to be either 5 or 7 year tenors. What's interesting about SFR as it relates to an asset class, it comps well versus, you know, and is traded off of different desks depending on how you look at it. Either it's considered to be more similar to CMBS because it is an income-producing managed asset that's rented out for profit. It also has features of RMBS, so it's occasionally traded off of RMBS desks because, in fact, the collateral itself consists of single-family homes, and those can be valued as single-family homes on their own. And lastly, you know, some desks consider this to be more similar to ABS because you're talking about a portfolio of essentially identical assets in large numbers so that you can kind of apply an ABS style analysis as well. So, and there's at the end of the day, you've got the individual credit of the renters on the line. So has aspects of ABS as well. So the fact that it's able to be traded off of or considered, you know, as part of all these different desks or investors means that it's becoming highly liquid. And probably the only thing that's limiting it is the amount of supply. And that supply has continued to grow, as Daniel had mentioned. So looking at the number of investors, I mean, we have probably between 50 and 100 investors looking at the space actively for each new issue deal that comes. They're regular investors. The majority of these folks are money managers, insurance companies, hedge funds, and inside those subcategories, there's a variety of different strategies that get applied. So from an asset class, I think we've reached the point where it's broadly accepted and it's got plenty of room to continue to grow. Now, when investors look at this, they often comp it to SASB because generally most of these SFR deals are single loans. The portfolio itself is considered the asset and it's a pooled asset, so you can't default on a single property and you know, throw it away and take a small loss to the trust. It's kind of an all or none situation. So the sponsor is going to do their best to ensure that asset performs because they don't want to lose the whole enchilada. The spreads these things trade at, interestingly, when you look at how the spreads comp, I mean, most of the deals are 5 years or 7 years recently, and there are some prepay and extension options, but those don't really come into play at new issue. They come into play more in secondary. But at new issue, we're talking about spreads for the senior AAAs in SFR space of in the 60s to 70s versus swaps. That compares with 5 year conduits in the 45 to 55 zone, 7 year conduits kind of on top of that in the 60s and 70s, and similar for last cash flow AAA conduits also in the 60s and 70s right now. So, right on top of that for senior AAAs. In SASB, because those are slightly different, they tend to be a little bit wider in the 70s, depending on the asset class, to even as wide as low 100s for AAAs. But most of them are in the 80s and 90s for higher quality portfolios. Looking down in credit, though, is where it starts to get especially interesting for SFR because SFR triple B and triple B minus, that tends to be in the mid 100s, like 150s and 160s. Looking at any of these other asset classes, you know, conduits, triple Bs are in the 300s, maybe even 400s. And SASB tends to be in the 200s and 300s. So from a credit perspective, going down in credit seems to be people are very comfortable with these assets from a credit perspective. In secondary, you know, trading volume has actually increased. And if you look what's happened since last year, I'm just going to kind of think about it from a pre-COVID perspective. deal flow and secondary was about $300 million a month. During COVID, there was some exacerbated trading volumes that I'm going to leave out here because the numbers get real high depending on what month you're talking about. But post-COVID, in kind of our new stable zone, we're seeing about $500 million a month, with some, you know, perk ups during certain times due to other extrinsic factors. One thing that I think folks are well aware of at this point is due to the large number of investors in the different classes, these are very liquid bonds. There's a tremendous amount of demand for these in secondary, and again, the only constraint is supply. Today, for example, there were a number of seasoned SFR deals that traded both AAA and AA, about $50 million, and they traded very well into you know, good investor bids. The majority of those things went directly into end purchases. And, you know, so what's interesting about this, it makes it a little bit easier. There's also a lot of transparency in the market. These are all traced, and so the information on the trades is easy to see. And we have a monitor that allows us to view that activity in real time, which I think a lot of other folks do as well. And it's certainly a useful tool. I think that's it for me here. Steve?
All right, Nick. Thanks a bunch. That's a great recap. So that's the end of our prepared remarks. As I mentioned, on the right side of your screen, there's a chat box for asking questions. And we do have already a number that are starting to line up. So I really do encourage you to take advantage of this, tap something into that little chat feature, and we will pitch the questions to our esteemed group of panelists. So the first one is really focuses on not just the current state of housing, but also the expansion plans of some of these operators. And the question that we're getting from the client in this case is how that strategy potentially plays out as the SFR operators expand, and in particular, whether it creates execution risks for their overall business and whether that potentially affects some of their operating results. Dan, I don't know if you have thought about that or have a view on those issues.
Yeah, I could speak to that. At the inception of the sector, the owner operators had a general view that perhaps 400 to 600 homes in a given geography would allow them to establish scale from a leasing and property management perspective, where they could have efficiencies and economies of scale to effectively manage the portfolio. Since it's such a new sector and kind of through learning through the headaches and growing their portfolio and optimizing the portfolio, it's more gotten into the thousands of homes in a given market that where owner operators view that they're able to deploy maintenance staff and effectively repair and manage those homes on an ongoing basis. So I would say one of the things that we've observed, and that definitely feeds into the pipeline of homes that operators are interested in acquiring and including in their portfolio. So in a single borrower context, I would say the average is in the mid-teens or so for the numbers, in the maybe low 20s in the number of markets in which operators own homes. And there's a overlapping geographic footprint in a lot of those markets. And it's not uncommon for one operator to have a more favorable view in any given market than a competitor. And oftentimes they may trade homes through a 1031 exchange, or there may be some level of bulk portfolio acquisition that takes place. But ultimately, however an owner-operator views their portfolio relative to a given market is unique to their own strategy. So it really depends on looking at it from a rent yield perspective, on and from a potential home price appreciation perspective, and whether or not that operator has the view that they feel that they can increase the rents in this given market. So I would look at it from that perspective, from optimizing a portfolio and kind of growing and developing those efficiencies through implementation of technology and deploying staff and how they would just operate their overall business. So I think couple levels, having the presence in the market, being able to effectively deploy their staff, and then executing on their overall strategy based on their view of the homes that are in a given market.
So let me follow up on that, actually. You said something interesting. You said that at the outset, when the market began, a lot of the operators thought 400 to 600 homes in a market was what they needed for scale. And then, if I heard you right, you said now their view is thousands. Were you saying that they've just decided to own more than what they need to get to scale? Or are you saying that the real requirement for scale instead of 400 to 600 is now that larger number?
Right. Yeah, just to clarify on that, as far as actually having maintenance staff driving from home to home or making repairs or making visits, actual on-site visits to the property, it really was more effective for them, and they really realized that cost savings when they ended up having, presently in most cases, having thousands of homes in a given market where there's less travel time between the homes. They're able to deploy similar amount of staff and spend less time actually traveling on the road, and actually that time is more effectively spent on site rather than in between the homes. So that's one of the things that a lot of operators have mentioned to us as they've developed more established businesses.
So does that mean that if I'm an operator and I'm thinking about, you know, really expanding my business into a new geography, I have to have some realistic expectation of amassing that scale of acquiring ultimately thousands of homes for me to make the economics work?
I think there's the proximity of the homes to each other is very important. So if someone were to have thousands of homes throughout the greater Atlanta area, or they had a smaller presence from an actual home count perspective, but I'll just throw build to rent in there. You may not, an operator may not have thousands of homes, but if they have a development with homes that are relatively close proximity to each other, that may also allow them to realize those efficiency through and the scale that they need to effectively manage those homes. These larger operators have contracts in place with vendors of the materials and supplies that they use. So as far as any interior appliance, for the interior appliances, flooring, carpeting, paint, siding, and so forth, getting those materials from one job site to the next, perhaps they'll realize efficiencies on that front too.
Okay, thank you. So we're getting a question now, slightly different topic. This one probably, Kevin, for you, or if there are others on the panel that want to chime in, it's open season. This one's relating to warehouse financing. And the question is, what's the current state of warehouse financing for these portfolios in connection with securitizations, just trends, terms, things of that sort? I don't know if you have a perspective on that.
Sure. So the bulk of the warehouse financing is provided by large money center banks, right? They're pretty big players in securitized real estate product. And as one might imagine, in a world like we're in right now, where there's a lot of bankers out there, a lot of places looking for money to work, and lots of competition for deals, the terms all around of warehousing and credit continue to get more aggressive. So, the general theme is that they will put forward more aggressive terms and most specifically pricing in order to capture what can be very large capital markets transactions. One of the interesting trends that we've seen more recently, and this is different than just about any other core commercial real estate asset class is that regional banks really haven't played much of a role in SFR. Some of them do specialty lending, like in the fix and flip space, but unlike, say, multifamily, you don't walk into a given regional bank and find a lot of SFR risk. But more recently, here in 2021, we've seen more of these regional banks that have the capacity to put up pretty decent sized checks, 100 million plus, that are interested in warehousing. They get the joke about SFR. Many of them thought, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago, it was more of a fad, and they've been proven wrong. And they're looking at the collateral performance of the asset class over the past year, and specifically relative to what they have in other CRE asset classes. And they're saying, gee, you know, this is an interesting risk-adjusted return for me to put money to work right now. So I would say that's one of the themes that we've seen that's different thus far in 2021. And, you know, we've partnered with a number of these players that we work with in other asset classes to put warehousing forward.
Okay. So let me just follow up on that. The private financings that you were describing before, do they in any way substitute or compete with the warehouse financing facilities, or are they really just alternatives to securitizations or other?
Yeah, I suppose at some level they may compete. I think what they really do, though, is complement what gets provided through a warehousing bank and then ultimately the capital markets. So we've obviously seen different markets over the years. Everyone on this line has seen them, where markets seize up, capital markets seize up, and people who run credit doing warehousing get nervous, right? And so the interesting benefit that this private financing tool provides is that it does provide term financing, particularly when it comes from insurance accounts, that while more expensive compared to a 144A deal for the borrower, provides a certain amount of funding capacity and flexibility, and is really in some ways a hedge towards the traditional, hey, let me ramp up in a warehouse with a defined exit to a capital markets takeout. And, you know, we insulate, and this isn't specific to SFR. I mean, we do this in a bunch of different asset classes with insurance and other funding partners. So I think it's really more of a complement, Steve, than it is necessarily competing.
All right. Well, you know what? Let me kind of take this inquiry over onto the rating agency side. I mean, Dan, do you or your colleagues end up reviewing these private SFR financings as well as the traditional securitization?
Once in a while, we've had a private rating request put forth, but generally, we're not seeing these deals cross our desk.
No. Okay. I mean, any observations on again what you may have seen on the private side relative to the public in terms of, you know, the attributes you're typically evaluating in a structured transaction?
Right. A lot of the elements that we've seen are very similar, and then the underlying portfolios are generally representative of the company's overall portfolio. So there's nothing that I could point out that would have been that would be unique as far as a reason for the specific collateral or anything. But our approach, how we viewed it, was generally the same.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. So again, more questions are flowing in. So again, thank you to our audience. Don't forget that chat box there. It's just waiting for you. So another question about build to rent, and in particular, whether they are included in securitizations. And so this one seems, again, Dan, directed towards you from a rating agency standpoint. You know, how would you think about differently haircutting those build-to-rent properties or otherwise stressing the assets? And this particular questioner is assuming, I guess, that there's no operating history, you know, for the investor to chew on before they make their investment.
Right. Just like any of the other deals that we would look at, we would look at the likelihood of stability of value and stability of rents and ongoing cash flows, and potential increases to rents and future cash flows that we could see. Really, we would expect, and we have seen the build-to-rent product on a very limited basis in securitizations. So generally in the deals that we rate, there's approximately 3,000 to 4,000 homes. There may be a small percentage generally that is built-to-rent product, but it's really been on a small scale thus far. But everything that we've received is in line with the remainder of the properties and the transactions, although there wouldn't be the operating history that you would have seen related to some of the other properties. Generally, when there are cases where there's new acquisitions in the first place, we wouldn't see a lot of performance history in the first place when there's new one-off acquisitions, or even if it's in some cases, smaller bulk portfolio purchases. But we would look at them generally the same, and I would look for stability of value and look at the transaction similarly as we would another deal. But we just haven't seen more than a small percentage added to any existing deal thus far.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna take that one over to Mary Beth, because Mary Beth, I know you've spoken to some people that have raised money for built to rent, and they seem to have a very enthusiastic view about where that's going. What color have you gotten about their expectations for that little segment?
I was actually going to, first of all, agree with Dan that the operators that are targeting build for rent are partnering with home builders. So you have a tremendous amount of efficiency right there. The strike point that most of the operators are identifying to get the maximum amount of efficiency is a community with anywhere from 200 to 700 properties in it. So all of those properties would be, and sometimes I know that Lennar is doing this, they're looking at a build for rent tenant section on the side of or as part of a larger homeowner property group. So you would have, here's a section of streets that are just tenants. They're all owned by one single family rental operator. And then you have the rest of the development, which is going to be homeowners, but it's all going to be one community. So from that perspective, yes, you get a lot of efficiency. You get to roll it into other deals. I don't know, and I was actually going to ask Dan, I don't know if they can get those properties into the deal while they're still under construction. I don't think that they do. I think they have to be on the way to getting their first tenant. I don't think they finance the construction process and the securitization itself.
No, there aren't homes like still in the construction process in any of the deals. You're right about that.
Yeah, so the construction process, I believe, takes anywhere from 18 months as long as you already have the land. And depending on how well developed the land is, does it already have electric? Does it already have gas? Does it already have services? Or is it raw land where they're going to have to, get the county to put in the septic, bring out the water, power, water, lights, everything else to them? But I think it's a great development. I think it's going to be really efficient. It's going to be attract a lot of people because single family rentals in general, the rent demand, the rent growth is rapidly outpacing multifamily. We're still so far behind in new construction that the outlook is for new home construction to catch up is going to take probably a decade, at least 5 to 7 years for that to start to catch up to the pace of household formation. So that's just going to push more people into single family rental homes. I honestly think it's a great sector. And I'm not talking about.
Okay. Well, we're waiting for the book to develop. All right, thank you. So I want to actually go back and ask a little bit about the importance of the sponsor. I think that's come up in a couple of different places in the conversation. And then just to let Nick Grego know, I want to come over to return to the secondary market, ask a little bit about the range of investors that he encounters there. But turning back to the sponsor, we talked a lot about the single borrower and the multi-borrower, and it would seem that the single borrower really puts a tremendous emphasis on the sponsor. Maybe even beyond the underlying rental assets that are pledged to a particular deal. I mean, Dan, does that figure in the way that you think about the creditworthiness of these transactions? And does it also, you know, figure in the way you think about the different business models that the various sponsors are pursuing?
As a part of our due diligence process for any of the securitizations, an operational review of the sponsor is one of the first things that we conduct. So getting an understanding of the platform, the senior leadership team for that company, and then there's the business strategy and what they're actually trying to execute are just a few of the high level things that we really do focus on. And that's what we perform very early on in the process before we even look at a deal, before we're engaged to look at a transaction. So that's something that is very important to us. Kind of along the lines you're asking, and like one of my other points earlier, most of the platforms operate with an internalized property management platform, and that's integrated with their internal systems related to leasing, collections, repairs and maintenance, and then just ongoing tenanting of the properties. But originally, a lot of those functions were contracted out to third parties, and the efficiencies that these companies were able to realize after their own experiences, pretty much like based on that fact pattern, a lot of them do have those efficiencies realized by internalizing those management functions. But overall, reviewing the not only the properties, the underlying portfolio, as you mentioned, but we do look closely to the sponsor at any given deal.
Okay, thank you for that. So Nick, I hope you got my warning flag, but there's a very broad question here on, you know, what is the range of investors involved in single family rental at this point, and has that changed in any material way over the years?
Yeah, I'm going to say that most of the players, especially towards the top of the stack, which is the most subscribed and often the largest number of investors play towards the top, is majority money managers and insurance companies. And when I say money managers, it's a very wide variety of money managers, large, small, medium-sized. And people will often look at these types of bonds as just another placeholder, a very high quality placeholder for other, you know, cash type alternatives, due to the high liquidity that you find in the SFR space and the strong credit. So, you know, with low concern about any kind of credit concerns and fairly short durations generally, you know, the top of the stack is a great place for folks who want liquidity and want a little extra carry. As you go down the stack, you know, there's a big drop off after the investment grade classes where, you know, some of the higher grade investors tend to drop off, but there's still dozens of investors looking at classes that are double B, single B, and below. Now that tends to be more of the hedge fund group, with folks who are looking for higher yields. And these bonds, you know, they tend to lever well, so you can actually buy these in the yield context of where they've been coming in the fours, the sixes for those subordinate classes. And then put leverage on them because, again, there's a high level of liquidity and lenders are repo lenders are very willing to finance these things. So quite a broad range. And as this sector has grown, itself, the number of bonds that exist and the, some consolidation and more efficiencies of scale that Dan was just talking about, more investors have heard about it. It's been in the press more, and that's attracted additional folks, crossover investors from other asset classes to come and take a look. So the market for secondary and primaries continues to grow.
So, Nick, let me actually spin my question for Dan in your direction and focusing on sponsors, especially when you're going down in the capital structure in the SFRs. How do your speculative grade or mezzanine investors weigh the different sponsors that they're encountering?
I mean, at the end of the day, you're talking about some portions of this asset class are, kind of fungible. So you're looking at the BPO value that's being securitized. Some issuers or some sponsors will put out deals that have relatively lower BPO attachment points to the first loss of that loan in the 80 type LTV range or BPO to value, BPO to loan range. Others will go out with much higher numbers. And so those higher numbers are actually even more interesting for certain hedge fund investors because that allows them to pick up some higher yielding bonds that otherwise wouldn't exist. If you have too low an LTV, then they're not really that risky and they tend to be higher rated. And so there's not a lot of excess yield. So when you go down in credit, folks are willing to go into high LTV, higher leverage loans to try and pick up some excess yield. And there's a lot of demand for that.
And I mean, do your investors think about the importance to the sponsor of effectively protecting their access to securitized debt?
Oh, absolutely. The sponsor is incredibly important. And, that's why I think when you look at some of the multi-borrower pools, you've got, much wider spreads that are not really comparable at all to the single borrower, single sponsor type pools. The sponsors have developed these economies of scale. They've learned all of the tricks about geographical location. They've brought a lot of the stuff in-house, and they're much more efficient than they used to be. And they're also much more aware of what needs to be done than they were 5-10 years ago when this first started. So when you're looking at smaller operators, those guys, they have a couple of different outlets, and you'll see some of them popping up in, what's called small balance commercial, or other programs that for portfolios that are extremely small. And then you've got these larger SFR multi-borrower portfolios, and those, because of the different risks involved, you've got multiple borrowers, one could default with that bringing the whole pool down, but they're also less sophisticated generally, and they're, while they're growing, they may not have the economies of scale that some of these larger operators do. So operator is incredibly important. Yes.
Okay, good. Listen, I'm getting a slew of questions as we kind of approach the end of our hour. So apologies in advance to our audience if I don't get to all of these. Okay. Whomever on the panel would be willing to try this one. From a client, given all the strong performance in these various single family rental portfolios, what are the current cap rates on homes? And are homes now more valuable as rental than they would be to the owner-occupant? Any views?
I will say I don't know what the cap rates are. I'm going to throw that to Nick because I think he follows it much more carefully than I do. I was on a call with the Urban Institute yesterday, they look at mostly low-income rentals, low-income tenants who are doing low-income single-family rentals, but it does fluctuate up into sort of the lower middle class as well. And one of their biggest concerns, we sort of spend a lot of time talking about this, is that especially in, there are some markets where absolutely, yes, single-family rentals have become more valuable, single family homes have become more valuable as rentals. And there have been more investor bids for those properties than there have been as home buyers, whether they're first time home buyers or later home buyers. One of the places where this has been a consistent problem, and we actually had a paper presented to us, has been in Milwaukee, where they said it's an area where the rents are relatively high. They're relatively high compared to other cities, compared to the average median income in those cities. But it's made investors from outside of Milwaukee and outside the state of Wisconsin have been buying up properties in Milwaukee and renting them out as out-of-state landlords. And there's a little bit of a presence for institutional operators, institutional SFR operators there, but it's actually very small because, again, Milwaukee is not a place that's been increasing in population or has a great amount of economic growth. So institutional operators have a very, very small footprint, but other investors have a very large footprint there. And that's been one of the issues. And I'm not sure what other areas are seeing that kind of pressure, but it's certainly something that a lot of government groups and housing groups have been following because, you know, if it's more efficient to be a landlord than it is to be a property owner and you can make more money that way, of course, now property prices going up as much as they are and it gets further and further out of reach of even middle income homeowners. I'm not sure what you do about that. Maybe the FHFA has tried to discourage investment properties in Fannie and Freddie's portfolio. I'm not sure what the motivation for that, but perhaps that was part of it.
So this is Nick Grego here. So I actually think the some of the other topics we've talked about on the call actually really answer that, and that's the build to rent program, which is going to increase the number of homes available for rental. The market I think is responding right now by producing more homes will be made available for renters, and as you increase the supply, you're going to see the cost to rent go down. Home affordability has been something, housing affordability is something that the government is deeply concerned with, and I agree with them. And the market here is actually responding exactly as it should by producing more product for folks to occupy, and eventually that will lower costs. Just my take there. And the debt yield question here for these deals, I mean, we've seen debt yields generally in the 5-6% range. And debt yield is typically, a proxy for cap rate, and you can back into the cap rate by looking at some of these numbers. But those numbers, for multifamily are pretty comparable to what you'll see. Sometimes in major markets, you'll see even lower cap rates for very stable properties. These are seen as extremely stable properties just due to the historical recent performance. And there's also additional components here, like, the ability to modify rents, depending on inflation projections. And if we are in an inflationary environment, then you reset the rent every year when the rents go up, when inflation goes up, to keep pace with that. So it's an asset class that can withstand a very low cap rate and still be pretty interesting.
All right, well, listen, thank you. And we, I think, have come to the end of our hour. What's clear from the remaining questions in the queue that everybody is very much interested in some of this policy risk. There's a question on the legality of the CDC eviction moratorium. There's a question on concerns in Congress about SFR operators potentially crowding out or large institutional buyers crowding out small institutional buyers. So I'm going to try to relay these questions to our local experts and see if they can get back to you. But in the interest of time, I just want to thank everybody, thank our panelists especially, but I also want to thank our dial-in audience. This is valuable time. We appreciate your investment in this webinar. We appreciate your attention this afternoon. And at this point, this wraps up another APS Portfolio Strategy call, this one on the state of the single family rental market. Again, thank you. Enjoy the rest of the day and good luck in the market.